The selection of porters was a lengthy business, and after Zuger had signalled his choice with a slap on the shoulder, the men were sent to Robin's tent to be examined for signs of disease or infirmity that might prevent them performing their duties. Then came the allocation of packs. Although Zuger had already made up and weighed each pack, making sure that not one of them exceeded the stipulated 80 pounds weight, the newly engaged porters had to watch the loads reweighed publicly. And then there was interminable haggling over the size and balance of the burden that each of them would carry for months, perhaps even years ahead. Although Zuger briskly forbade Pereira to hasten the selection process with his kerbash, and entered good-naturedly into the spirit of banter and bargain, he was in fact using the occasion to assess the spirit of his men, to pick out the malcontents who would sour that spirit in the hardships ahead, and also to select the natural leaders to whom the others turned instinctively for decision. The following day, when planning the order of march, Zuger used the knowledge he had gained in this way. To begin with, seven of the more obvious troublemakers were given a ket of beads each, and ordered out of the camp without explanation or apology. Then Zuger called out five of the brightest and best, and made them captains of divisions of 20 porters each. They would be responsible for maintaining the pace of the march, for preventing pilfering of the loads, making and breaking camp, distributing rations, and acting as the spokesman of each division, presenting complaints to and transmitting orders from Zuger. When the roll was complete, there were 126 names upon it, including Sergeant Chirut's Hottentots, the porters who had come up from Quelimane, Camacho Pereira, and the two principals, Robin and Zuger himself. It would be a slow and unwieldy caravan, unless properly organised. That was bad enough. But on the march it would also be very vulnerable. Zuger gave much thought to defence of the column, and he and Sergeant Chirut shared the last quarter bottle of whisky as they pooled their experience and planned the order of march. Zuger, with a small party of local guides and personal bearers, planned to travel independently of the main caravan, reconnoitring the terrain ahead of the march, and making himself free to prospect and hunt as the opportunity arose. He would return most nights to rejoin the caravan, but would be equipped to spend many days out of contact. Camacho Pereira, with five of the Hottentot musketeers, would lead the van of the main column, and even when Robin chafed him lightly, Zuger saw nothing ludicrous in Camacho marching under the Union Jack. "It's an English expedition, and we will carry the flag," Zuger replied stiffly. "Rule Britannia," Robin laughed irreverently, and Zuger ignored her and went on describing the order of march. The divisions of porters would remain separate but closed up, and Sergeant Chirut, with the remainder of his musketeers, would form the rearguard of the column. There was a simple system of signals to control the movements of the column. A prearranged series of blasts on the kudu horn trumpets would sound the march or halt, the close-up or form square. For 4 days, Zuger exercised the column in these evolutions, and though proficiency would come only much later, at last he felt that they were ready to make a start, and he told Robin so. "But how are we to cross the river?" she asked, looking across to the north bank. The river was half a mile wide, and the heavy rainfalls over millions of square miles had drained into it. The flow was swift and powerful. If they were going northwards to the Shire River and Lake Marawi, they would need a flotilla of dugout canoes and many days to make the crossing to the north bank. The steam launch Helen had long ago departed on the flood of the river, making good at least 20 knots with the current pushing her, so she would already be back in Quelimane. "All the arrangements have already been made," Zuger told her, and she had to be satisfied with that. On the last day, Robin allowed Juba to accompany her to the cemetery for the first time, and both of them were laden with gifts. Bolts of trade cloth and a 35-pound bag of ceramic beads, the most sought-after scarlet Samsam variety. It was as much as she dare ask for from the expedition's stores, without arousing Zuger's ire and interest. She had thought of telling Zuger of Sarah and the child, but had wisely decided against it. Zuger's reaction to finding a half-brother of mixed blood was too terrible to contemplate. Zuger had acquired his opinions on caste and colour in the hard school of the Indian Army, and to find that his own father had trespassed against these iron rules would be too much of a shock. Instead, Robin had mentioned that she had met one of her father's former servants who tended their mother's grave over the years. The gift would have to be in proportion to these services. Sarah and her child were waiting by the grave, and she accepted the gifts with a gracious little curtsy, and her palms held together at the level of her eyes. "We leave tomorrow," Robin explained, and saw the immediate regret in Sarah's eyes, followed by acceptance. "It is God's will," and Robin could almost hear her father saying it. Juba and the child soon became involved in collecting the pods from a kaffirboom tree nearby and stringing together the pretty scarlet lucky beans, each with its little black eye at the end, to make necklaces and bracelets. The two of them, girl and boy, made a delightfully uninhibited pair, their laughter and shrill, happy voices a pleasant background to the talk under the acacia tree. Robin and Sarah had become friends in the short time they had known each other. Her father had written in his missionary travels that he preferred the company of black people to white, and certainly all the evidence seemed to point that way. It seemed that Fuller Ballantyne had done nothing but squabble with his own kind. Contact with other white men seemed to bring out in him all the pettiness, suspicion, and jealousy of his complex nature. While he had spent the greater part of his life with black men and received from them trust and honour and lasting friendships, his relationships with Sarah was only a natural extension of these feelings. She contrasted these feelings with those of her brother and knew that he could never cross the dividing line. A black man could possibly earn Zuger's liking and even his respect, but the gulf was too wide. For Zuger, they would always be those people, and she guessed that he could never change in that. If he lived on in Africa for another 50 years, he would never learn to understand them, while she, within weeks, had made real friendships. She wondered if, like her father, she would come one day to prefer them to her own kind. It didn't seem possible now, but she recognized in herself the capacity for adjustment and change. Beside her, Sarah was speaking so softly, so shyly, that Robin had to make an effort to tear herself away from her own thoughts and ask, "What was that you said?" "Your father, Manali. Will you tell him about the boy when you find him?" He did not know. Robin was stunned, and Sarah shook her head. "Why did you not go with him, then?" Robin demanded. "He did not wish it. He said the journey would be too hard. But in reality, he is like an old bull elephant who does not like to stay too long with his cows, but always must follow the wind." Camacho Pereiro towered above the wiry little tribesmen, checking off their names against the camp register. This evening he wore a jerkin of kudu skin that was decorated with fancy stitching and trade beads, and unfastened down the front to expose bulging hairy chest and the flat belly with its ridged muscle, like the patterns in the sand of a windswept beach. "We feed them too much," he told Zuger. "Fat nigger is lazy nigger." He chuckled when he saw Zuger's expression, for that word had already been the cause of dissension. Zuger had forbidden him to use it, particularly in front of the expedition's black servants. For some of them, it was the only word of English they understood. "Feed small, kick heavy, and they work hard," Camacho went on with relish. Zuger ignored these gems of philosophy. He had heard them before many times. Instead, he turned to the captains of divisions and watched them finishing the rationing. Two of them, their arms floury to the elbows, dipped into the bags of meal and doled it out to the shrinking line of porters. Each man had his calabash or chipped enamel basin to receive the scoop of stone-ground red-brown grain. Then one of the other captains slapped the split and smoked river fish on top of the pile. The fish looked like Scotch kippers, but their odour punched like a prize fighter. Weevils, maggots and all, they were a delicacy that the porters would miss once they left the river. Pereira suddenly hauled a man out of the line and hit him with a lusty clout across the back of the head with the stock of his kerbash.
He come twice, try for double, he explained cheerfully, and took a playful kick at the man as he ran.
If it had landed, it would have knocked him off his feet. But all the porters had come to anticipate Camacho's flying boots. Zuga waited until the last porter had been rationed. Then he called to the captains. Indaba, tell the men, Indaba. It was the call to council, to discuss affairs of consequence, and the whole camp left the cooking fires and came hurrying agog with excitement. Zuga paced up and down before the ranks of intent, squatting black men, drawing out the moment, for he had come quickly to realize the African love of the theatrical. Most of them could understand the basic Nguni, which Zuga now spoke with some fluency, for many of them were Shangans or Angoni. Now he spread his arms to his audience, paused for a second, and then announced portentously, Kusasa Isufari, tomorrow the march begins. There was a hive murmur of comment and excitement, and then one of the captains rose from the front rank.
Fi! Fi!
Where? Which way? Zuga lowered his arms and let the suspense build up for a few moments, and then he stabbed out towards the far blue southern hills with a bunched fist.
Lapahaya!
That way. They roared with approval, just as they would have done if Zuga had pointed north or west, for that matter. They were ready to go now. The direction was not important. The captains of divisions, the Ndunas, were shouting out the translation to those who had not understood, and the first roar of the crowd settled to a boisterous rumble of comment and speculation. But it died away suddenly, and Zuga turned quickly. Camacho Pereiro had stepped beside Zuga, and his face was swollen and dark with rage. This was the first time he had heard Zuga's intention to go southwards, so that when he started to speak, it was so forceful that droplets of spittle flew from his lips. He was using one of the local dialects and speaking so swiftly that Zuga understood only a word here and there. The sense was unmistakable, however, and he saw the shock on the faces of the men who squatted before them. Camacho was warning them of the dangers beyond the southern hills. Zuga heard the word Monomotapa and knew that he was speaking of the terrible armies of the legendary empire, merciless legions whose favourite sport was to cut off a man's genitals and force him to eat them himself. The shock of the listening black faces was changing swiftly to terror, and Camacho had been speaking for only a few seconds. A minute more and nothing would induce the caravan to march. 2 minutes more and most of his porters would have deserted by morning. There was nothing to be gained by arguing with the Portuguese except an unseemly shouting match, which would be watched with interest by the entire assembled camp. One thing that Zuga had learned was that the Africans, like the Asians, had come to know well in India, were immensely respectful of a victor and impressed by success. He could demonstrate neither qualities by becoming embroiled in an undignified wrangle in a language that none of the spectators could understand. Pereira, he snapped, in a tone that cut through the Portuguese's torrent of words, and for an instant stilled them. Zuga had the Englishman's peculiar sense of fair play, which made him warn an enemy before an attack. As the Portuguese turned to face him, Zuga swung in towards him with two light steps, and he flicked his left hand at Camacho's eyes, forcing him to throw up both hands to protect his face. As he did so, Zuga slammed his fist into his belly, just under the ribs, with a force that doubled him in the middle, his breath whooshing out of his gaping mouth in an agonized explosion of sound, and his hand dropping to cover his injured belly, leaving his face open for the next blow. It was a short, chopping, left-handed shot that took Camacho cleanly under the right ear on the hinge of the jaw. The plumed beaver hat spun off his head. His eyes rolled up into his skull, leaving the whites glaring madly, and Camacho's knees gave way under him. He pitched forward, making no effort to cushion his fall, and dropped face down onto the grey, sandy soil. The silence lasted only a second, and then a shout went up from the watchers. Most of them had felt Camacho's boots or his kerbash, and they hugged one another happily. The trepidation that Camacho's little speech had raised was completely lost in wonder at the swiftness and the effect of those two blows. Most of them had never seen a man strike with a bunched hand, and the novelty of this form of combat impressed and delighted them. Casually, Zuger turned his back on the prone figure. Not a trace of anger showed on his face. In fact, he was smiling slightly as he strolled down the front rank of men and lifted one hand to quieten them.